Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Before the break, we were talking about an historic first for the Boston Police Department because William Gross was sworn in today. He's the city's first black police commissioner. But there have been other big changes with BPD in recent weeks. Namely, the department will introduce some 400 body cameras, according to an announcement from the mayor's office last week. Though the city has not made public specific plans on when this will happen or which police officers will be wearing the cameras. Now, the news comes after the release of a long-awaited final report on the BPD's body cam pilot program. Here's Jack McDevitt, the director of Northeastern's Institute of Race and Justice and co-author of the report.
We were able to determine that officers with cameras in Boston, the 100 officers who wore the cameras, that they had fewer uses of force and that they had fewer complaints against them. And these changes, these differences were statistically significant.
Now, it's been a long and somewhat tough road to even get to this point for the city of Boston and the Boston Police Department. So we wanted to get some reaction from Shakia Scott. She's founder of the Boston Police Camera Action Team, an activist group that has been advocating for mandatory use of police body cameras. And she joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here today.
So first of all, it seems as if this final report on the pilot program is pretty laudable. It says lots of good things about the use of body cameras. I mean, what's your biggest takeaway?
I think the biggest takeaway is that regardless of the small pool of officers that wore the body cameras, this did generate small and again, meaningful and significant benefits, as noted, to the civility of police and citizen interactions. And it offered, as we just heard Jack McDevitt say, that complaints went down and fewer uses of force were generated. And so the biggest takeaway from this is that these cameras work and they give us insight into police day-to-day interactions and how we can improve those and make that relationship between civilians and police more a trustworthy one and one that's more accountable.
Yeah. You know, what I found interesting in the report is that it said that, if I remember correctly, that the mere presence of body cameras wasn't enough to fully lead to better interactions or de-escalation, that what was really key was if there's high compliance of the requirement that officers inform people they're interacting with, that there is a recording being made. And that's one of the things that made a big difference. So one of the things that it makes me think of is the devil's always in the details.
Right.
And how exactly are these 400 cameras now that the city is purchasing, you know, how are they going to be deployed? Who's going to be wearing them? What are the rules around which the body cams will be used? We don't really know any details about that so far.
We don't. And that's one of BPCAT's major concerns. And by the way, that's what we call the Boston Police Camera Action Team for short, BPCAT. And that was one of our main concerns to begin with. So back in 2014, when we were generating our model policy for how this should outroll, one of the key things that we did introduce in that policy was that officers should announce that they are wearing the camera, because once someone is aware of that, then we see that decrease in escalation of the situation. But again, like you pointed out, if they're not aware, they just go about their interaction as they would have.
Do you have confidence in the city and in the Boston Police Department to be totally transparent about the rules they put in place or how they're going to roll out the program?
With the new commissioner being sworn in today, which is historic, and congratulations to William Gross. Again, he was definitely one of the major influencers of getting this through. But I have confidence, but I would like to see straight out the bat meetings happening with community members, key stakeholders, advocacy and activist groups around this issue to make sure that all of them are at the table to come up with a comprehensive and community-oriented policy that ensures accountability as well as makes civilians feel that they can entrust officers with this footage of themselves and give them more trust and insight into the everyday operations that will happen with the camera.
Yeah.
And with the footage.
You know, I wonder what you make of the process this far, just to get to this point. And I ask because we've reached out to the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't responded to our request for comment. And the latest that we heard from the city of Boston, it was from Mayor Welsh's statement when they said they were going to buy these 400 cameras that they are in conversations mm-hmm. with the police unions. Now, I just wanted to give that as a background here because, you know, for folks who remember last year when the pilot program was launched, it wasn't really the smoothest launch. Like, they got the rank and file might have been for this, but the police unions provided some pushback. So are you concerned right. that you might feel that same pushback with a permanent program?
I am concerned about that. And we, when the preliminary study came out kind of midway through the pilot program as it was extended at that point, they did announce that they would have to do renegotiations and reconversations with the unions to renegotiate full implementation. So that was concerning as the process up to now has technically been a fight. It went all the way to the Massachusetts Superior Court as the unions were against it, and they didn't want it. So now that it's here, I'm not sure if it will be that much of a fight now that it's been you know, supported by the mayor, supported by the leaving commissioner, Commissioner Evans, and clearly supported by our new commissioner, Commissioner Gross. But I'm hoping that it's not that much of a fight and that we can definitely develop policy quicker than we did yeah. for the pilot.
Well, we have some tape here from Tanisha Sullivan. She's president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, talking about sort of the ups and downs of the process of getting body cameras on Boston police officers so far. And she told us about the power of community advocacy.
This was not an easy road. It wasn't as if, you know, community advocacy organizations and residents were initially invited to the table. I mean, there had to be a bit of a push. But I think ultimately what we're seeing at the end of this process, even though there were some pain points in it, is an overwhelmingly positive outcome.
Shaki, I wanted to just switch gears here a little bit and ask you, do you think that the report examined enough of the pros and cons of wearing the body cameras from the officer's point of view, from the men and women who are actually going to be wearing them?
I don't. I do see they did have a qualitative data section where they did send out a survey, but that survey was only answered by 42 of the 100 officers that were outfitted. So we don't really get a real perspective behind the actual officer wearing the body camera and if they felt themselves more safer in their interactions or if they felt they needed additional tools to help them complete their day-to-day activities due to having the camera. But we do see other qualitative data that's very specialized to officers that did bike rides from Northeastern, and they gave great feedback on how the camera works and that it doesn't interrupt their daily activities. However, I do feel like there was room to definitely gauge more officers, interview them, as that survey only went out once in the very beginning of the pilot program, and it could have been reintroduced in the middle, at the end, and then we have more of a collective voice that says from the officers, these work, they help us, and we're not against them.
And so as we move forward now, you know, there's always the question, there's a couple of questions, well, there's actually hundreds of questions around police body cameras, to be perfectly honest, but one of them has to do with, you know, privacy, public records laws.
Yes.
Is that something that you hope the community has input on, or have you heard, what have you heard from BPD so far?
I haven't heard anything in regard to the privacy from BPD, except for what they outlined in the policy for the pilot program, and that was kind of you know, copied and pasted from BPCAT's initial proposed policy, which outlines that the body camera would have to be turned off or turned on in specific instances to protect privacy. And one of those privacy concerns was that people would need to be notified mm-hmm. that they were being taped. It also outlines domestic violence cases, as well as when you're entering someone's home. And so I would encourage everyone to take a look at that proposed policy to see. But I would definitely love if community was as at the table to discuss what their concerns are and to get what's the most important key policy privacy concerns of theirs into the policy before this actually goes live.
Yeah. And finally, I wonder what you think about this. I mean, Boston is behind other major American cities in terms of implementing a body-worn camera program. We talked about sort of the rough road to get to this part, to get to this point so far. But on the other hand, we're here.
Yeah.
I just wonder, is there also the risk, and this is completely on the flip side of things, to put too much stock in the potential of a body cam program? I mean, I understand there's it can bring transparency, it can bring evidence, it can bring a greater sense of accountability, both for officers themselves and the members of the community they interact with. But it can't solve all the problems that we have with policing. Do you think that there's the concern that it's going to be close to a magic wand when it's not? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes. So I do have the concern that people may have that idea, but that isn't the point of the body camera. The body camera is not supposed to be a silver bullet by any means. It's supposed to identify and expose those areas that need fixing within the police department and outside of the police department, and highlight those for us on video so that we can then go back and say, okay, are the policies that officers following, are those policies de-escalating? Are they promoting de-escalation or are they promoting escalation? And then from the camera and through those interactions, we can go back and say, all right, let's change this policy so that what the officer is doing in that interaction does not promote escalation, but promotes de-escalation. So this provides us a deeper look into the system and if it is working correctly on a whole. And so we don't have to focus on this being a silver bullet, but helping us get to that point of creating multiple policies and initiatives that can help us cure this relationship between police and civilians.
Yeah. Well, Shakia Scott is the co-founder of the Boston Police Camera Action Team. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, around the turn of the century, researchers in Cambridge and Boston helped lead the Human Genome Project. Of course, that was the one that sought to map every gene in the human body. Well, now scientists at the Broad Institute, a genetics research center in Cambridge, are working on another project of similarly massive scale. It's called the Human Cell Atlas, and it aims to map every cell type and how it works to better understand what goes on in our cells and what goes wrong when we get sick. For our Common Health segment today, WBUR's Karen Weintraub brings us this report.
If you flip open a biology textbook or do a quick search on Google, you'll quickly learn that there are a few hundred cell types in the human body.
And it's true, because in broad categories, a few hundred is a good characterization.
That's Aviv Regev, a core member of the Broad Institute. But look a little closer, as Regev has been doing, and a different picture emerges.
No one really knows how many there will be. Anyone who says so is making a guess. People guess anything from the thousands to the tens of thousands. I'm not guessing. I would rather actually get the measurements done and have a precise answer.
For instance, immunologists count more than 300 cell types in the immune system alone. The eye's retina has over 100. Sarah Teichman co-chairs the Human Cell Atlas Consortium, along with Regev.
It's kind of like we're trying to find out what are all the different colors of Lego building blocks that we have in our bodies. And we're trying to find out how those Lego parts fit together in three dimensions within each tissue.
The Atlas will also show how these Legos communicate with one another, says Jay Rajagopal, a developmental biologist at Massachusetts General Hospital, who is involved in the work.
I mean, I tend to think of cell tissues really as like societies where cells are the individuals, and there's a lot of communication from one cell to another.
He and Regev published a paper last week in the prestigious journal Nature exploring the cells that line the windpipe, the tube that connects the throat with the lungs. Instead of the six cells they thought they'd find there, the scientists identified seven. And that could prove crucial for understanding and eventually developing a cure for cystic fibrosis. Until now, researchers believe that the disease was caused by a faulty protein made by a common cell in the windpipe's lining. But they now believe that the bad protein is made in this rare seventh cell type, which they named pulmonary ionocytes. Rajagopal says the difference sounds small, but it could save years of wasted research effort trying to repair the wrong cell.
It sort of changes the problem.
Scientists who developed newer drugs did it without knowing about the seventh cell. These treatments give cystic fibrosis patients hope of living into middle age.
And the progress has been amazing, and so things are getting better, but we ultimately do want to work towards some kind of durable cure.
Rajagopal says a cure won't be possible without targeting the precise cell where the faulty protein is made. It's this kind of finding that makes the Human Cell Atlas worthwhile, the researchers say. The National Institutes of Health agrees and has already committed about $200 million to the project. Sarah Teichman, the co-director of the Atlas, says she expects it will take another 5 to 10 years to complete. But when it's done, it could improve treatments for diseases from asthma to cancer.
There's huge potential. Huge potential. And there's very clear things that we can learn by drilling down to the single cell level in those diseases.
The work has echoes of the Human Genome Project, which wrapped up in 2003 for a cost of $3 billion. Here's Aviv Regev of the Broad again.
We knew the lesson from the Human Genome Project where rallying together the entire community would really let you get a full answer to a question, and that full answer will empower everyone to do better and faster and higher resolution biology.
Mapping the body's cells won't solve every problem in medicine, just as the Genome Project didn't lead to immediate cures, she says. But it's a good place to start.
That report from WBUR's Karen Weintraub. Now, folks, I want to tell you that tomorrow we're going to be bringing you a special hour of Radio Boston at 3 o'clock because we will be hosting a one-hour debate between Congressman Michael Capuano and Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley. They are running for the congressional seat in Massachusetts' 7th District. The debate is going to be at UMass Boston, and we will be asking both Capuano and Pressley about the future of the Democratic Party, about economic development in the district, about their records of leadership and their ideas, and so much more. It is part of our continuing political coverage this midterm season, hosted by, yes, we here at WBUR, by the Boston Globe and the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. You can hear this special debate live at 3 o'clock here on 90.9 WBUR. We'll also be broadcasting a Facebook live feed of the debate. Again, that's at 3 o'clock tomorrow. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.